There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I'm your host. On today's program, finally, the Senate confirms us a chairman of the FCC. And when we get in the radio, things are heating up over the Performance Royalties Act. Sides lining up on pro and con. What do you think? You do want to stay tuned. So as we go to air and tape tonight on the 25th of June 2009, we have the loss of Michael Jackson, who died apparently today, was in a coma before that. But more importantly, for those of us concerned about the future of our communications, the Senate finally confirmed Julius Genachowski as the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, a Democratic appointee appointed by President Barack Obama, and also confirmed Robert McDowell, who has been serving on the Federal Communications Commission. He took over the chair, the seat, shall we say, vacated by former chairman Michael Powell, and filled out his term, and now will start his own very first full term. He was also confirmed by the Senate, and he is a Republican. And I don't remember a time recently when the FCC has gone so long with an interim chair at the turning over and the changing of the guard in the White House. I haven't done the research to back up how long it's been. But word leaked that Genachowski would be the nominee back in January of this year. And he was finally nominated in March. And in June now, he's finally going to be the chair. Just a little bit of paperwork needs to happen for him to fully assume the duties. And a little over a week ago, Julius Genachowski and Robert McDowell appeared in front of the Senate Commerce Committee, which is the committee of the Senate which oversees the FCC, and they got a little bit of a grilling. I would say they took a pretty light hand to them, but chairman of that committee, Senator Jay Rockefeller, a Democrat from West Virginia, made it very clear what needs to be done. He told Genachowski, quote, "Fix this agency or we will fix it for you." What he told is that the two men is that the FCC's performance has been disappointing, telling them, quote, "Too often FCC commissioners have focused on making sure that they advocate the ideas and needs of the companies that they regulate and their bottom lines," end quote. He went on to say that the commission has, quote, "shortchanged consumers and the public interest," end quote. He also said, quote, that this is why he's deeply interested in FCC reform and continues to weigh the merits of FCC reauthorization, end quote, calling into question the FCC's budget and therefore its existence. But nevertheless, they continue to confirm him. And also, the big boogeyman of right-wing and conservative radio reared its head as well. I'm talking about the Fairness Doctrine, which they have been wringing their hands over coming back as a way to get at the likes of Rush Limbaugh, even though nothing has been floated in Congress, and the FCC has said nothing about it. But Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, a Republican, asked Julius Genachowski about it, and he responded that he does not support it. He said, quote, I believe strongly in the First Amendment. I don't think the FCC should be involved in censorship of content based on political speech or opinion, end quote. Now, Robert McDowell, Republican commissioner, currently the only Republican commissioner at the FCC, and they can have two right now, has sort of raised the specter of the fairness doctrine. There's been this interesting conflating of issues that's happened on the part of the radio industry and many on the right wing, trying to paint issues such as network neutrality and internet freedom, trying to paint efforts at promoting localism as similar to the fairness doctrine as initiatives that would impinge on free speech. And McDowell previously has, shall we say, participated when in front of friendly conservative audiences in that conflation. But he declined to jump on that bandwagon in front of the Senate Commerce Committee, acknowledging that there has been no talk about the fairness doctrine there. You can read more about that from my colleague Matthew Lassar over at our group blog at radiosurvivor.com. But yet, we still do not have a full FCC. Jonathan Adelstein, who has been a long-lasting Democratic commissioner through the Bush administration, is leaving and needs to be replaced as well. Mignon Clyburn is President Obama's nominee for that position. And the White House announced today that Meredith Atwell Baker is his pick for the one Republican open slot on the FCC. Generally, by tradition, when there is both a Democratic and a Republican open slot on the FCC, they are usually shuffled through Congress for approval together as a package, generally not considered separately. And so since we have one more Republican and one more Democratic seat, it looks like there are two women up for that. Typically, the Republican nominee is offered by senior Republicans in the Senate, typically. And vice versa, Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, who were the two Democrats under President Bush, were both offered up by the ranking Democrats in the Senate. So we finally now have a full FCC. Oh, not a full FCC. I'm sorry. We have a new FCC chairman filling in for interim chairman Michael Copps, or taking the seat from interim chairman Michael Copps. But that still leaves the FCC at 3 out of 5 commissioners, as now Jonathan Adelstein can hit the road, being that there continue to be 3 with 2 more seats left to fill. They might be able to get on with business soon enough. It's up to the Senate Commerce Committee to consider Meredith Atwell Baker and Mignon Clyburn and to send them on to the Senate to start getting some business done. And there's a lot of business left there at the FCC yet to be done. There is a little bit about broadband stimulus and having a national broadband plan. That is something they're supposed to have by the end of the year, been mandated by Congress as a pretty big deal. Something that also Julius Genachowski wants to look into, has said publicly, is the tethering of phones to service. You know, if you want to have an iPhone, you have to have AT&T. One of the smaller, but still rather large-sized cellular companies, U.S. Cellular, which is a pretty big presence in the Chicago area, has complained vociferously to Congress and to the FCC that because of these exclusivity deals between handset makers and cellular providers, they cannot offer a full range of phones to their customers, especially not some of the hottest new smartphones like the iPhone or the Palm Pre. And what that effect does is deprives a lot of rural cell phone users of having iPhones and such, because there are areas of the country where you cannot get AT&T or Sprint service, but where U.S. Cellular is the primary provider, meaning you are deprived of any phones that are covered under exclusivity deals. And while this might sound like poor rural users, note that much of the innovation of bringing internet to cellular users, to mobile handsets, the innovations in having mobile broadband are happening on these new platforms, especially the iPhone, which, you know, has thousands and thousands of applications available to it. So having such exclusivity and such deals can really count out a lot of people. So that's something which we expect to see come in front of the FCC in the very new future. And you are listening to Media Geek. This is Media Freedom and Our Right to Communicate, a weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manella. I am your host, and Eric Yarnell is at the controls. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog. The radio show is at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can get the podcast or you can download it and listen. Whether you missed it on the air, that's how you listen, or you want to catch it again, Radio.MediaGeek.net. Comments about the program, live or later on, send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And if you use the Twitter, we're taking your comments about anything we're talking about tonight. Twitter.com/mediageek. So there's this bill that's in Congress and has passed out of the House's Energy and Commerce Committee called the Performance Royalties Act, the PRA.
Heard a lot about it.
We've heard a lot about it, and we have talked about it here on the program, but it's continuing to get a lot more press, and it's what the radio industry and other aligned groups are starting to call the radio tax. And what this particular bill would do is it would remove the exemption that broadcast radio has enjoyed from having to pay royalties on the performance rights of recorded music. So when you have a piece of recorded music, say it's Michael Jackson's Beat It, there's several rights associated with it. There's a songwriting, and so that's anyone who is listed as a songwriter receives royalties when it's played on the radio, when it's played in jukeboxes, when it appears on albums. And all radio stations, including WNUR, pay this royalty to the songwriting unions, ASCAP and BMI, the two major ones. There's another royalty called the performance royalty. And this is something which goes back to whoever holds the performance rights on the record. So the estate of Michael Jackson now receives royalties from songs like Beat It when they're played on satellite radio, when they're played on internet radio, when they're played in jukeboxes, or that same recording is played elsewhere. However, broadcast radio does not pay any of these performance royalties, and historically has not, but it's been specifically exempted by federal law.
And Eddie Van Halen, who of course played on Beat It, would also get.
He might. What's interesting about that is, I think this is very apropos the arguments over the performance royalties, is that it's not always as simple as the artist who played on a record receives the royalties from it. And that's because the rights that you hold in a particular recording, you can sell or sign away. And it was a very common thing, especially in the earlier days of rock and roll and recording, for a record contract to basically entail an artist signing away the performance to the record company. And, you know, it's similar to the fact that if you're a reporter for a newspaper and you write an article, you typically do not have the copyright on what you wrote. It's called a work for hire. The newspaper retains the copyright even though you wrote it. And in many cases, on a lot of recording contracts, especially brand new artists who might have just been signed, do not retain the rights to their performance on the record. Even though they're the performer, the rights stay with the record company. And so the radio industry is doing its best to paint the Performance Royalties Act as a way to simply fatten up the coffers of the major recording labels who they argue stand to profit the most. On the other side, of course, are a lot of artists who are saying, why does radio get this exemption when satellite radio is paying it, internet radio is paying it? You know, we own these rights in many cases, and we deserve what we get. And often with minor label or independent label artists, it's much more common that the artists retain their performance rights. Much less common that independent labels, especially independent labels associated with indie rock or punk rock and such, make artists sign away their rights to the performance royalties. So they're saying, gosh, you know, we're doing badly enough. This is another revenue stream that we ought to get. And we don't see a reason why radio ought not to have to pay it. So there is a bill sitting in Congress. There is a, it's in the House of Representatives, currently has 43 co-sponsors. But now there is a opposite bill going up against it called the Local Radio Freedom Act, which was pretty much brought on by the National Association of Broadcasters, which currently enjoys 237 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. And basically intends to continue the exemption that FM radio enjoys from these performance royalties. But what we've seen is something that you pointed out to me recently, Eric, is that there's a bunch, many more players kind of getting into the act to lobby against the Performance Royalties Act.
Absolutely.
It's the Performance Rights Act. I should get that correct. Right. Performance Rights Act.
A lot of people, very divisive. A lot of people taking sides, mm-hmm. All through. And some people, it's kind of a... maybe have their foot in both camps, and they got to make a decision who they're going to support.
Well, what's interesting is there's a couple of groups. So you point out an article to me at the FM Quarterback, fmqb.com, which is a music radio industry journal online. And one was called HelpSaveRadio.org. Which asks the question...
It's a petition.
Rhetorically, yes. How important is your local radio station to your community? And what's interesting is you look at this website at helpsaveradio.org, is it looks a lot like some grassroots campaigns like savetheinternet.com, stopbigmedia.com. They're using a very similar even layout and template and ask you to sign a petition that goes to your... to your local representatives saying that please reject House Resolution 848 and Senate Resolution 379. Now, this one, rather transparently, I'll say, is sponsored by Greater Media Incorporated, which is an owner of about 25 FM stations in the Northeast in markets like Boston and Philadelphia. And I'm glad to see that it's not what we call an AstroTurf group, which is a group which appears to be grassroots. It could be something called People to Save Radio. But when you look underneath and you pull up the turf, you realize it's actually funded and completely run by a large lobbying organization. But this they're being quite straightforward.
See, it didn't fool me, but when you see Help Save Radio, the huge banner at the top of the website, and you're a radio kind of a radio leaning sympathizer like myself.
Well, exactly.
It just kind of, and I'm sure a lot of people signed the petition just after seeing that, didn't care what else it
they
said.
They might not have read it too closely. And I saw this other group, which I saw noted, that I thought was very interesting because it's called the Free Radio Alliance at freeradioalliance.org. And when I think free radio, I tend to think of pirate radio and unlicensed radio. And so if I didn't know better, I thought, wow, this is a huge alliance out to support the rights of unlicensed broadcasters. No, it's keep radio in your community free and strong. Oppose a tax on free radio. And it's a very clever use of semantics in this argument to say, save radio, keep radio free, which they mean, I think mostly to the listener, which I think shows no signs of changing. But they're calling now this a radio tax, which is apparently something which everybody else has to pay, but broadcast radio does not. And they have a huge list of members, including, major broadcast groups, including the Illinois Association of Broadcasters, National Association of Broadcasters, lots of stations. There are other groups like Latino Coalition, the NAACP Salt Lake branch is also a member of this coalition, as is National Public Radio, National Religious Broadcasters. Again, not AstroTurf from the standpoint is that they seem to be not trying to appear too grassroots. Looking up who is behind this particular group, it is a PR firm that is organizing this, and the PR firm is I think it's the DITUS group. It's formerly the DITUS group, now DITUS Communications, DITTUS. It's a company now owned by Financial Dynamics, started by Gloria DITUS. One interesting thing in this same article that you sent to me was a site called Creative Deconstruction, which, as far as I can tell in my research or looking up domain registration on this, is not itself an AstroTurf group. It says it started in 2009 by a guy named Refe Tuma, designed to keep the conversation going and help artist bands and those willing to embrace new ideas seek innovative solutions to the problems and opportunities that face their industries. It's creativedeconstruction.com. And it is also opposing the radio performance royalties, but by basically taking the position that it's just a bad idea. And so what they've published recently on the 17th of June is five reasons why the Performance Rights Act is a bad idea. Number one is that it would cripple local radio, and that's something which we've been hearing over and over again. Two, it says the Performance Rights Act hurts independent artists.
And this was the most interesting thing to me reading this list.
And his justification is, I've heard some supporters of this bill touting that the independent artists have the most to gain. This is because the money would go to the performance and copyright owners, which in the case of independent artists are the same thing. Therefore, the PRA would provide a potentially significant revenue stream for the artist, right? In a perfect world, maybe, but in this world, playlists at major stations are chosen by advertising dollars, not DJs, which is not entirely correct. Adding an additional fee for every song play will only make stations even more unwilling to take risks on unproven acts. Independent acts have a hard time getting on major stations. They don't need another hurdle. Number three, they say, is payola, where, you know, is something where the record labels pay in order for songs to be played on the air. It's illegal to do this unless the station also acknowledges payment. One might recall a couple of years ago, Elliot Spitzer, when he was Attorney General in New York, reached settlements with major labels in New York based upon the fact that they had essentially engaged in payola by big payments through independent marketers who then made payments in various forms, sometimes not necessarily money, but in terms of goods and services to radio stations.
Promotional
enticements.
Yeah.
Four, he says the bill is based on misinformation. According to a recent press release by the Music First Coalition, a lobby group created a push for the PRA, radio should pay performance royalties because it's the only platform that currently does not. They accuse broadcasters of believing that AM and FM radio stations should continue to get special treatment, that AM and FM music stations do not have to play by the rules, and that AM and FM music stations should enjoy competitive advantage over other platforms. The problem is that they are ignoring the fact that they were the ones who created this disparity, which is true. When the other platforms, such as online streaming, were required to pay performance royalties, it had everything to do with controlling the reproduction of digital music, a problem not shared by terrestrial radio. That's interesting, though I'll note that home taping, as it was once known in the 80s, was once quite a big obsession of the music industry, not quite as big as their obsession with file sharing is currently. But there was a very well-known symbol which showed up on records and tapes during the 80s, which is a symbol of a cassette tape with a skull and crossbones that said home taping is killing music. And primarily they were going after people who, of course, would tape their CDs or tape record albums and share them with people, but were also targeting people who taped off the radio. And I know that the industry at a time tried to get up all in arms for the practice of radio stations who would play album sides. It was not uncommon for rock stations, especially album rock stations, so-called album rock stations, to play an album side at midnight or something like that, especially a new record. Finally, the PRA doesn't benefit musicians as much as the RIAA claims. And so he leans quite a bit on Jesse Walker, who is a writer for Reason magazine, which is a magazine of libertarian thought. And Jesse Walker's actually published a very good book on unlicensed radio and radicals on radio called Rebels of the Air. And as I read through this set, what's interesting to me is I have to say that I really can't come down on either side of this argument over the Performance Rights Act. I see arguments on the both sides, and I think that the battleground is so already bloodied that it's hard to pick a winner.
Well, and I think I may this comment to you off the air. I mean, this whole thing is like, you know, two mortally wounded gladiators,
yes,
just going at it, because both industries are unfortunately I think in decline
and arguably desperate. In decline because of misplaced priorities.
Yes, absolutely.
For the radio industry, because the major players primarily focused on acquisition of stations, consolidation of resources, the destruction of local radio and localism on radio, over-leveraging the purchases to the extent to which they are now forgot about the internet, never leveraged it to their full advantage, and are carrying too much debt to make any creative changes or choices. And the recording industry, kind of a similar line, I think we can argue that failed to embrace the internet as a distribution medium until really Steve Jobs and Apple forced their hand with the creation of the iTunes Music Store and really mainstreaming the MP3 player as the iPod. A lot of people probably don't realize this, is that when the first MP3 player came out in the latter part of the 90s, I believe the RIAA filed suit to try and stop it, with the absurd claim that it would contribute to music piracy. But, you know, since the MP3 reared its head in the late 90s, you know, and the reason why that's important, it was the first really feasible file format for the exchange of digital music over the internet. Because prior to that, there really was no good compression scheme that the computers of the day could handle, and that would create a file size small enough that you could easily exchange. And, you know, we're talking about the internet days of when still the majority of people who had internet were using modems, and those who did have broadband didn't tend to have the speeds that they do now. So the MP3, which was really an accidental creation, it was really a creation of hackers. It was buried in the specification for what's called MPEG-2. So it's actually a video specification. MP3 is buried in there. It's MP3... Was it MPEG? It's MPEG 1 layer 3, I'm sorry. MPEG 1 layer 3, so it's an audio specification buried in a video specification, which was never intended for this use, in which hackers looked at it and said, wow, this is pretty efficient. We could use this to exchange music online. But the music industry, rather than jumping on the bandwagon or finding ways to exploit it, seeing, hey, here's a new market, here's new ways to make money, threw everything they had at it. And I think, similarly to radio, in focusing their battle on destroying MP3 and destroying file sharing and online music, never thought about how they could better exploit online resources to perhaps sell music in new ways and new forms and promote artists in a new way. Basically missed the boat, and now are sitting themselves right with declining revenues as people, you know, are more interested in playing video games, watching Blu-ray movies. You know, I think that it is fair to say that the multi-channel universe would probably have eroded their business anyway, but that perhaps they could have more easily and earlier taken part in the multi-channel universe had they not been chasing the P2P pirates. But so, yes, I think it's the two gladiators duking it out. And that brings to a close this edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at radio.MediaGeek.net. That's where the podcast lives, or you can listen in your browser. You can also catch programs you might have missed. Radio.MediaGeek.net. Send comments to Paul@MediaGeek.net. The Twitter feed's at twitter.com/MediaGeek. Also, check out my new group blog, all about radio and its future, radiosurvivor.com. Lots of great stuff, joined by Matthew Lassar and Jennifer Waits. All about radio at radiosurvivor.com. Media Geek is produced here live, the studios of WNUR-FM in Evanston, Illinois, on the campus of Northwestern University, and continues to be aired at the founding station, Community Radio WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois. Yeah. Thanks for tuning in.